From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Well, here's how we're going to line up today. We were expecting to start this conversation with Winsome Sears, the Republican candidate for Virginia Lieutenant Governor, but we are reliably informed that Winsome Sears is now traveling in Southwest Virginia, from which it is pretty difficult to get good telephone reception.
She ought to be on the moon.
We will try to see if we can get her during the course of this broadcast. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Robert J. Conte III. Robert Conte is the chief of police for the Metropolitan Police Department, and just this morning, he was with D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser as she announced some new initiatives in crime fighting, so to speak, in the district. So we will talk with him later in the broadcast. We're going to start with a conversation with Gabe Albornoz, who is the council vice president of the Montgomery County Council. He joins us now. Gabe Albornoz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo, and I hope my connection's better here in Rockville.
It sounds pretty good so far.
It's not quite Southwest Great. Virginia.
That's right.
Before we get specifically to the issue of what's going on in Montgomery, Tom Sherwood, let's talk about what seems to be going on budget-wise in Maryland, Virginia, and the district. Maryland reported a $2.5 billion balance still in their budget. Virginia ended its fiscal year with a $2.6 billion surplus, and D.C. is expected to end the fiscal year with a $500 million surplus. What's going on? We thought the budgets would all be in trouble.
Can I just first say about Winsome Sears, I hope she calls in. Sydney Grannon, our excellent producer for the Politics Hour, has worked for weeks to have her on and the Democratic candidate, Haya Ayala, next week. And so she's known about, Ms. Sears has known about this interview for some time, for a couple, at least a week or more, and she is suddenly in Southwest Virginia. And I was joking about the moon, but it's not much different. The state is spending tens of millions of dollars to improve health, cell service, and internet service there for the people out there. And for her to be there and not able to talk to us is very irritating. I hope she gets somewhere where she can talk to us later in the program.
And Sherwood knows about this because he was once the Virginia reporter for the Washington
right.
Post, so he has traveled up and down in the state.
And I will say, as poor as it is, it's one of the most beautiful parts of Virginia is to be in Southwest Virginia.
But difficult for cell reception.
Yes, but yes, an internet connection. So let me just say that last year, at the beginning, 20 months or so ago, at the beginning of this COVID crisis, every jurisdiction, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., local government and state, worried about their collapsing economies. You fast forward, if you can, fast forward through this pandemic to now, through the American Rescue Act, I think it was called, and the number of federal programs that have poured money into our economies. Maryland and Virginia and D.C. are flush with money. In a political year, the issue now is not so much do the states and local governments have enough money, it's can they spend it quickly enough. You know, there are all the issues of renters, subsidizing renters who are losing their apartments or are about to lose them. Whether or not there's enough medical service available to help people who are infected. All the things that a government has to do simply to run, they have the money to do it, but it's very difficult in a pandemic to spend the money. So that's where we are. Lots of money all around.
Does this please you, Gabe Albornoz?
Well, it certainly does, and we really do have to give a lot, and I mean a lot of thanks to our federal partners, because we were anticipating some really significant holes in the budget before this last year. But we also have to be careful, because these federal funds are going to run out, and so we have to make sure that we are investing them wisely and in a manner that's sustainable, too. But there's no question, they've gotten us through some extraordinarily dark times.
Can we, before we get to very other issues, less important issues, can I ask him about the most important issue today? Mr. Albornoz, are you ready?
Tom Sherwood has decided what is today's most important issue, so please follow carefully.
I wouldn't expect anything less from
Tom. I want to know if you're going to even be at this event. Maryland plays number 5 Iowa tonight at the University of Maryland, formerly Byrd Stadium, named for a commercial company now. I hear that you are a major fan of the Maryland Terps. What do you think? Iowa's number 5. Maryland's trying to be undefeated.
Okay, can we move on?
He's got to get it quick. You get 10 seconds to answer.
I haven't been this excited about a Maryland football game in a long time, and if I didn't have a family commitment, I absolutely would have been there in person. But rest assured, I'm DVRing it, and we'll be watching it later tonight.
In your prediction, who's going to win?
I think Maryland's going to win. I think we.
You could not say anything else but that.
And we've got some real momentum going into this. We finally have a quarterback.
Okay, we have to go on because you can't see the face. See Kojo's face. We have to move on.
Tom will be recording it on his VCR, which he still has after all these
That's
years.
That's right.
Two of your colleagues introduced a bill that would require Montgomery County government employees be vaccinated. Under the bill, employees would not be given the choice of undergoing regular testing instead of getting the vaccine. They could receive a medical exemption, but not a religious one. What do you think about that proposal?
I support it, and I understand the risks that the county executive has enumerated with the concerns that there may be some staff members that will quit as a result of this mandate. But I think through some combination of fear and stubbornness and political ideology or just plain old misinformation, we've gone as far as we can go, educating our county employees and all of our residents, frankly, on the validity of this vaccination. And we know how important it is for their health, for their community's health. And Kojo, this is going to be my 15th year working in county government. And I take public service very seriously, and I know our employees do well. It is a privilege to serve our public, and we have to do it in a manner in which is safe and that ensures the safety and security of the residents that we're trying to serve. And also the employees that are serving alongside each other on the front lines, trying to provide high quality public services here in Montgomery County. So I'm very supportive of this legislation. It will obviously go through the legislative process. And as you noted in your introduction, there is already a challenge to what Montgomery County Public Schools has tried to do with the religious exemption.
Let me clarify that for our audience. Montgomery County Public Schools did not allow religious exemptions for its staff vaccine mandate until it was sued by an employee who said the mandate infringed on his First Amendment rights. And so now the county schools will allow the religious exemption. Should this apply, in your view, to other county employees?
At the moment, I don't think it should. I think we have to follow that case closely. And obviously, as is always the case with all legislation that we pass, we will follow the law and what the judicial branch mandates. But, you know, we've seen in the District of Columbia, as an example, I read somewhere recently that hundreds of firefighters have, you know, requested the religious exemption. And that defeats the purpose of the mandate in the first place. We have to ensure that all of our county employees are vaccinated for them to be able to safely carry out their services. And the other thing I'll note here too, Kojo, is analysis is starting to come forward. So New York and California issued mandates within their healthcare fields. And there were a lot of the same concerns raised by the county executive that it would lead to a significant number of people quitting their jobs. And what they have found in New York and California is quite the opposite, that most people retained their jobs and did so, you know, in a way that they weren't particularly happy about, but they were able to do it. And the other good piece of information is the vast majority of our county employees are already vaccinated. And so we're talking about a small overall percentage.
I think I was going to ask you about that. Is it correct you have about 9,500 county employees, not counting the schools, and that 77% of them are, in fact, at least partially vaccinated, at least one shot? And so you are talking about a small group. And you are right, the county executive, Mark Elrich, has said that he's surveying the government now in order to see what would happen if you have a mandate, because he says that he has to both balance the mandate with the critical county services. And unlike in the district and some other places, the unions appear not to be going along as well with the county government as they are somewhere else. Is that correct?
Indeed, the unions call it an outrageous intrusion and are calling it a union bashing bill.
So how do you tell people that this is a public health emergency, a pandemic, and that I don't understand the religion. What is the religion? There may be religions, and I apologize for not naming them, that says you shouldn't inject yourself with something. But what is the religious exemption that people are asking for? What does it mean?
I'm
a Seventh-day agnostic. Do I get to not
get? Candid with you.
I'm sorry?
But I actually don't know, to be perfectly candid with you, which religions would disqualify and which would not.
Well, I can tell you about the county schools employee. He identified himself as a Christian and said he had a conversation with God about this, and that's why he came to his conclusion. But I don't know if there are any other religions that people will invoke. I'm pretty sure there are.
Yeah, there probably will be. But I think, you know, there's risks all around here. There's risks in enacting the mandate. But in my opinion, there are many more risks in not enacting the mandate, because we know all that I believe we need to know about this vaccination at this point. It is safe. It has been injected in people 100 years old, literally. And we know its efficacy. And we know that it helps contribute to diminishing community spread. And we run a risk, especially as things get colder, as we get into the fall and we get into the winter, and we know the rhythm of this virus. It will inevitably go up until more people are vaccinated. And we run the risk of not being able to run calls if a fire station goes down because too many of the employees within that fire station get the virus or are in close contact with somebody who has gotten the virus. And we are also seeing more evidence of breakthrough cases because we have not been able to entirely wrap our arms around community spread.
You're the former recreation director for the county. I've forgotten how many years you were that. But what is the policy now? So all the recreation centers, as you say, this fall and into the winter, will have events. And what will be the concern there? Will all those employees, recreation employees, be vaccinated so that parents can bring their children and adults can come to the rec centers?
Well, that's what we're trying to ensure with this policy, because right now the great news is the vast majority are. But because it's a survey, it's a self-survey that's indicating how many of our county employees have actually received the vaccination, I think the number is actually a little higher than around 74%, which is what has been reported. Some people just haven't taken the time to fill out the survey for a variety of reasons. But this is exactly why we want to make sure that all of our county employees are vaccinated so they can provide their services safely. And I'll note as well, gentlemen, that I've received some direct messages from county employees who are represented by my friends in labor who have indicated and said thank you, finally, that this is moving forward. And so there's not a universal opinion within our labor-represented employees about this, and the vast majority of them are vaccinated, and many of them are expressing frustration with their colleagues that are not.
When would this be decided? When would the county board take this up and make a decision?
So it's going to go to the Government Operations and Health and Human Services Committees, and I chair the HHS Committee, and my colleague and friend Nancy Navarro chairs the Government Operations Committee. Our hope is to get it on the calendar later this month, where we will discuss and deliberate, and then hopefully move it to full council as soon as possible and enact this before the end of this calendar year.
And if enacted by the end of the year, which means if you pass, the council passes it, maybe Mr. Elwich may veto it. I don't know if he will or not. And then all of that at the latest by the end of December?
Yeah, okay. I think that's about right. And I certainly hope he chooses not to veto this. But, you know, and my colleagues understandably are gathering information as they should, especially looking at the legal guidance to make sure there aren't any, in addition to the unintended consequences the county executive has articulated, that there may be other legal challenges. I think the juice is worth the squeeze on this one.
It does seem to me that the tolerance for people, the small group of people who are undermining this nation's effort to overcome the pandemic, is getting smaller and smaller. I certainly have lost personal tolerance, people around me who are not vaccinated and act fairly boldly about it.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Gabe Albernaz, who is the council vice president of the Montgomery County Council. In case you were expecting us right now to be talking with Winsome Sears, the Republican candidate for Virginia Lieutenant Governor, you should know that Winsome Sears is apparently traveling in Southwest Virginia, where telephone communication is difficult, despite the fact that she and her staff knew in advance that she would be scheduled to conduct this interview, and that Southwest Virginia is a particularly difficult place in which to get cell phone reception. She has not joined us. We have received a number. There are at least five people waiting on the line with questions for Winsome Sears. And what we'll do is, before we come to the end of this conversation with Gabe Albernaz, we will allow those listeners to have their questions at least aired. And maybe Tom Sherwood can answer a few of them, but we'll have to see what happens, because we know that you have been waiting for a while to participate in this segment of the show. And because of the absence so far of Winsome Sears, you have not been able to. Later in the broadcast, we'll also be talking with Robert Conti, the chief of police of the Metropolitan Police Department. Gabe Albernaz, where is Montgomery right now in terms of vaccination rates?
Well, we're over 90% for children over the age of 12, and we're close to 90% for our overall population, and it's even higher in the most vulnerable category. So I believe we still lead the nation for a jurisdiction of our size in our vaccination rates, and we've also made tremendous strides in our minority communities through a lot of incredible efforts in the community by community leaders. And so I believe our Latino community is number one.
Yes, more than 64% of Latino residents have received their first dose, compared to about 59% of white residents and about 54% of black residents. But in the case of the Latino community, tell our listeners, who is Abuelina and what role she played in this?
Oh, great question. So our Latino Health Initiative is one of our three minority health initiatives and programs, which is our organizations, associations made up of healthcare clinics, nonprofit organizations, community leaders that band together to advise the county and provide a bridge in outreach to our multi-ethnic and multicultural communities. And as we celebrate often and can't celebrate enough, Montgomery County is one of the most diverse counties in the entire country. And so particularly during the pandemic, for a variety of reasons, we wanted to make sure that both the messaging and the communication back and forth with our healthcare professionals was done in a way that was culturally appropriate. And so my colleague and friend Nancy Navarro and I, early on during the pandemic, in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services, realized that we had a problem, that there was a point back in August where over 74%, over 6 weeks, of our positive test cases were in the Latino community. And so we just did a full court press and worked with a communications firm that developed a really culturally appropriate and wonderful advertisement campaign that went in line with the grassroots efforts. I mean, we were at Home Depots, we were at fields, we were at malls, we were at faith-based organizations disseminating information, fighting against all of the false information that was out there. And we also hired dozens of health promoters who spoke Spanish and other languages as well, that really did a magnificent job of answering questions, alleviating fears. And Abuelina is the name of the
it's a cartoon character,
essentially,
really?
The character that we devised. And my mom, I think, is listening. Abuelina reminds me a lot of my mom and my Aunt Luli and other trusted women in our families who we all often turn to for advice and guidance and to get the right information. And so the campaign hit all the right chords, and it has been immensely successful.
Congratulations.
Well, I checked Abdulina out this morning, and if I were not already vaccinated, she would have convinced
That's
me
right.
to get vaccinated.
She'd give you the look. You've mentioned Nancy Navarro, the council member who's term limited. Do you know what she's going to do once she leaves office? Has she publicly said?
She has not, but Nancy has earned the right to do whatever she wants to do, Tom. She has just been an outstanding member of this council, a great friend, but I don't know what her plans are.
You've announced your re-election for a second term. You're going to use public financing. Are you going to participate in the county executive race? Are you going to support someone there, either Mark Elrich or David Blair or Hans Reimer, maybe Tom Hucker, one of your other colleagues?
Well, I appreciate the question, Tom.
I know you're not going to answer it. I have to ask it.
Well, I have a good reason, though. So I am transitioning into the council presidentship in December, and I think it would be wildly inappropriate for me to be active in that race, certainly publicly, because, you know, we have to maintain a strong working relationship with our county executive. Two of my colleagues I know have expressed interest in running, so which is not unusual. And so we want to minimize the political noise as much as possible. And I will not be endorsing in the county executive's race. But if anybody wants to ask me for advice, you get what you pay for. But I'm happy to return phone calls.
And public financing is working pretty well in the county?
Oh, it's working extraordinarily well. It's been a game changer in leveling the playing field and also ensuring that we have a diverse set of voices in each race, which I think is terrific and great for our democracy.
We got an email for you. What is your view on the Thrive 2050 zoning proposals? I live within a mile of a Red Line metro station, and I am horrified by recent announcements that the county planning folks are recommending lifting zoning restrictions so that our wonderful single-family neighborhood could be riddled by teardowns replaced by quad and octoplexes.
So check, please. I'm just kidding. I think Thrive is generating a lot, and understandably so, a lot of correspondence that we're getting both by email and social media, but also in person. I've been able to make it out to more events in person these last few weeks. And here's the bottom line for our listeners. This is an update of what's called the county's general plan, and we gave it this catchy name. But we were due to update that plan to reflect the changes that have been occurring over the county over the last 30 years. And understandably, there have been concerns raised about people not having felt like they were sufficiently informed about what's in this plan. The plan is over 200 pages long. One of the sections that has generated the most interest is some of the recommendations made by my colleagues on the planning board staff about creating more attainable housing, especially more attainable housing closer to mass transit facilities and adjusting zoning to make that happen. I've become really respectful of the council's process. Our Fed committee is taking this up right now, and they will work through, along with our incredible County Central staff, addressing the myriad of issues and concerns that have been raised. And I think at the end, we're gonna end up with a product that probably won't satisfy everyone, but we'll use reasonable as its barometer.
You have a new county official, Jake Weissman, who's a veteran of the state legislature, who's been hired to be the economic development director in Montgomery. There are some people who complain Montgomery has fallen behind Northern Virginia and others in economic development. Richard Madalino has hired Jake Weissman. It's kind of a little inside baseball, but do you know anything about him, and do you expect him to be good at what he's supposed to do?
It doesn't get more serendipitous than this. He was the last meeting I had right before being interviewed by you fine gentlemen. So I met him for the first time virtually about an hour ago, very impressed. His reputation precedes him in Annapolis, and I think his connections with the state are going to be very valuable. He's going to have to hit the ground running. He has no choice. And so he'll have to establish relationships quickly to be able to take advantage of some of the economic opportunities that we have here. We focus too much on the deficiencies. I think we got a lot more opportunities. But I was impressed by him, and I think we're going to be in good hands, and I stand ready to help him in any way I can.
There's a controversy over the Silver Spring business.
We only have about 30 seconds left in the segment, so we're going to hold that question until we come back Our guest is Gabe Albornoz. He is a council vice president on the Montgomery County Council. If you have a question or comment for him, you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or tweet at Politics Hour. You can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. When we come back, we'll take some of the questions that were for Winsome Sears. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. In the first part of our conversation, we were scheduled to speak with Winsome Sears, the Republican candidate for Virginia Lieutenant Governor. But Winsome Sears has, in a way, made herself unavailable for this conversation by traveling in a part of Virginia in which cell phone reception is very poor, even though she knew that she had this interview scheduled. And next week, we will be talking with the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Hala Ayala. Winsome Sears is the Republican candidate, and that interview will take place despite the fact that Winsome Sears did not appear today. But in view of the fact that she has not appeared, several of you have called. So before we get back to Montgomery County Council Vice President Gabe Albornoz, I want to take some of those questions that were raised.
I got some questions, too.
Well, we'll wait for yours. Here is Brandon in Northern Virginia. Brandon, what's the question you have for Winsome Sears?
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm a bit disappointed that Winsome didn't show up because it makes me wonder if she'll take her commitment seriously. It's a little ridiculous that she wasn't able to show up. But I had a question about vaccines, since that's such an important issue to me as a college student. You know, President Biden and Mitch McConnell have both reported getting their COVID-19 booster shots. Does Ms. Sears plan to get hers? And does she think that boosters should be mandated?
Well, we were unclear as to whether she had her vaccination.
That was my very first. That is my very first question for her.
You seem to know that. Did she? Was she vaccinated? As far as you know, Brandon.
You know, one thing that's been kind of concerning to me as a college student who is doing their research on both candidates as kind of an undecided voter is that Ms. Sears is not publicly stating whether or not she is vaccinated. And that concerns me as, you know, other Republican officials, including I think the ones who are running for statewide office, have announced that. And so for me, it makes me question, I guess, whether she is someone right. who can lead other Virginians in serving as like a role model.
I did a thorough search on the web trying to find out whether she had said anything about it or whether she said she's vaccinated. I think it's important. Glenn Youngkin, the Republican candidate for governor, has been quite clear. He says he's vaccinated. His family's vaccinated. He thinks people should be vaccinated, but he is against mandating vaccines in any other circumstance. He says it's up to the person to make a personal choice. But for Winsome Sears, we do not know.
And in that regard, thank you for your call, Brandon. In that regard, we have a question for you on this vaccination issue, Tom Sherwood. Here is Iman in Rest, Virginia. Iman, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm Iman from Rest, Virginia.
Thanks. I am sorry, Iman.
Yes, no worries. I just wanted to ask you to express disappointment and those who are not taking the vaccine. I'm curious if you heard the...
You're breaking up, too. I hope you're not in Southwest Virginia yourself, Iman. Where are you? No, Iman is in Reston, so we should be hearing you clearly. Try again. Uh-oh.
She was asking, I said, I'm disappointed and irritated and lost patience with people who don't get vaccinated. She was about to say why, ask a question about that. I'm not sure what it was, so I
Me
can't
either.
Respond to it. I couldn't.
Iman, are you there? Can you hear us?
Tell her to text it in.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
we can.
Okay, so I'm wondering if you've heard the perspectives of Dr. Robert Malone, who is the inventor of the mRNA technology for vaccines, or Dr. Peter McCullough, who's one of the most published MDs in the country, Dr. Tess Lowry, who is a world-class science researcher, Dr.
Wait a minute. There are also individual scientists who don't believe in such a thing as climate change or who feel that the evidence doesn't support it.
What is your question? Am I aware that some doctors think the vaccine is dangerous? Is that what your question about me? Go ahead.
The question is you've heard people who are getting frustrated with people who are around them. I'm just curious if they've heard the perspective.
Okay.
Now, what is that perspective?
High-level doctors who
what,
are very
what is the
pers- who are
what is their perspective?
I know the answer to this, Coach.
No, please. What is their perspective?
Their perspective is that the VAERS data is very alarming and that there are safety signals. 30,000 women in the U.K. have reported reproductive issues, and they're now just looking into this after many, many doctors.
Okay, here's Tom Sherwood.
I am aware that there are legitimate concerns people have, strongly held views. I'm aware of the matter in England, which is being reviewed about women changing their menstrual cycles and all. I'm aware of all those things. But in the context of the entire world, in the context of what the vaccine is doing to save lives, to minimize infection problems if you get it but don't die, the idea is that you should be vaccinated. If you have a legitimate reason, if there are medical reasons, and I know people have medical reasons why they don't want to get it, that's understandable. But this broad scale, when 20% or something of the country doesn't want to be vaccinated, we are in a public health crisis. You have an obligation in this country, if you're going to be out in public, to not infect other people. If you want to stay home, if you can stay home, and you want to stay away from all of us in public, do so. But I have lost tolerance with these ideas that, oh, it's too dangerous to take. You take other vaccines, we have measles and all those other things. The problems with the vaccine are such that you should, given the weighing the life choices, you should be vaccinated.
And I was simply making the point myself that there are always individual scientists, and in this case, medical practitioners,
they're opposed to
who go against the overwhelming majority of what seems to be a consensus.
Our call, but totally disagree with it.
Here is someone who identifies themselves as a supporter of Winsome Sears, Susan, in Virginia Beach. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, I have been a supporter, but I have to tell you, I'm very disappointed that she didn't show up on the show today. That's very concerning to me. And also, what is concerning to me as a supporter is that some of the issues that she supported that are important to me, she has taken off the website, her website. So things like Second Amendment rights and protecting life. So I was wondering, what I wanted to ask Ms. Thier is, does she still strongly support the Second Amendment rights and protecting life? And if so, why did she take them off her website? Doesn't show a commitment.
You mean the website no longer has a photo of her bearing or carrying a weapon? Because I've been looking at that photo this morning.
If you look under issues, she's removed some of the issues that she highlighted before. I'm just really disappointed not only for her not showing up, that her supporters can ask her questions, but that those issues are no longer on her website.
I have not seen any backsliding from her on the Second Amendment and all the stuff that I've read and seen about her. However, I do want to ask her about the abortion issue from Texas. She has publicly said that she supports the Texas law, which essentially would outlaw abortions after 6 weeks, a short time when some women don't even know they're pregnant. And that's a very big issue. And I would like to ask her about that.
You're going to have to reach out to her at another time, because she's clearly not appearing on this show today. Right. And we do have to move on with the guest we have, Gabe Albanos, Council Vice President of the Montgomery County Council. The council voted to override County Executive Mark Eldridge's veto of a bill that creates a Silver Spring Business Improvement District, or BID. Why do you think that was an important step? Because that step that you took, overriding it, was opposed by both Will Jawandu and, of course, the county executive. They say the bid will not further the county's racial equity goals, since it would benefit large property owners and not enough small businesses. Jawandu said that the bid doesn't have the buy-in from black business associations nor the local Ethiopian business community. How do you respond to those concerns?
Absolutely. So this has been a very important and emotional conversation, but I think where I landed was the pros outweigh the cons with regards to being able to move forward with the bid, and that there's a lot more agreement than there is disagreement. There's agreement that we've invested billions of dollars in downtown Silver Spring, and it is a treasure. And what makes it a treasure is the remarkable tapestry of multicultural businesses, both small, medium, and large, that make up downtown Silver Spring. what's also universally agreed upon is we have a problem, and we need to stop the bleeding. We now have over 28% vacancy rate among commercial properties, and it's growing up high as well within our retail properties as well. And there were challenges prior to the pandemic in which many of the same small businesses who have expressed concerns with what was enacted by the council were the same small businesses that said, help, please. And we were able to narrow the focus of the mission of the Business Improvement District to focus exclusively on marketing. And so that addressed some of the concerns initially raised in the report looking at the racial equity aspects of the legislation. It no longer, as an example, includes the red coats, who are affectionately known, the staff who literally wear red coats and staff downtown Silver Spring. They're staying in the executive branch, continuing to be represented by their union. And I would also note, too, that everyone agrees we can't do nothing because that is not acceptable either. And while not perfect, there are a number of organizations who are supportive of what has been put forward, including the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the Long Branch Business League, and many others. It's hard to get complete consensus on everything, but what's clear is that we need to invest and market Silver Spring to bring it back to where it was not that long ago, because there is concern of growing crime issues in downtown Silver Spring that I think we need to address holistically, in part by bringing back some of the vibrant economy that we had prior to the pandemic. And
I think, all things being equal, this does that. I've driven through there. I've seen some of the empty storefronts and like many places, downtown D.C. and others, people need to do whatever they can to bring people back as long as there is racial equity and access for all the businesses, small and large. Thanks.
Gabe Albernoth is the council vice president of the Montgomery County Council. He's a Democrat. Gabe Albernoth, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, gentlemen. Can't wait to come back on.
You don't get as much time next time.
That's all right.
Joining us now,
I promise better reception here in Rockville.
Once again, thanks. Joining us now is Robert Conti III, the Chief of Police of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. Chief Conti, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Kojo. My pleasure to be here.
You joined Mayor Muriel Bowser for a press conference this morning to outline the focus areas for the city's fall crime prevention initiative. What specific neighborhoods are you focusing on, and what does this initiative look like?
So we've identified five neighborhoods, Brightwood, the Benning Road area, Bellevue, Washington Highlands, Historic Anacostia, and Columbia Heights. And we're really focusing on those areas after doing really an in-depth analysis of looking at violent crime that's occurred there, some recent incidents that have occurred in some of these areas, the number of shot spotter instances that we've had, but identify these areas as part of our focus for the fall period. In that, we intend to have additional resources deployed from the Metropolitan Police Department to address some of those acute chronic issues that are occurring there. But in addition to that, we expect to get support from our other government partner agencies to address some of the concerns that the community may be experiencing there that are not necessarily law enforcement issues.
You mentioned Brightwood. I think in the Kennedy Street area is known as Brightwood Park, and I suspect that's where more of the focus might be. That's certainly where the Ward 4 council member Janice Lewis-George has been asking you to focus on. Is this in part a response to her request?
Well, we're already have been focusing on that area, actually, since the before they even had the shooting that they had up there where the six people were shot. There have been some recent incidents that happened after the six people being shot where we've had a significant amount of resources deployed up there. But the Fall Crime Initiative for us, it's a continuation of what we have been doing, and then the additional piece of adding in the other government partners to kind of help focus in on that area. There are really some acute issues there that need to be addressed. We've been recovering, several firearms up there in that community. But again, beyond what MPD does, I think there has to be kind of really a holistic approach to Kennedy Street.
Chief, this is welcome to the show. This is the Politics Hour. Ward 4 Councilmember Janice Lewis-George has been a person very critical of the police department and in the wake of George Floyd. I think the department's down about 200 officers from authorized strength. Is that right?
Yeah, it's over 200. It's okay. Probably closer to 300 now.
Closer to 300. Has the council's actions in trying to improve the police department but reduce the number hamstrung your ability to prevent or pursue crimes and criminals?
Well, it certainly makes things difficult when you don't have all of the human resources that you need. I think, you know, I don't know, people may try to argue different things, but the reality is I haven't been to a community where they say, hey, chief, we want less police officers. And that's not to suggest that a police officer in the block will stop every crime, you know, and I think that, again, that's a hard metric to really put your arms around. How many crimes don't happen because a police officer is in community? We don't know that. But what I do know is that residents feel safer when we have those officers out there for the most part, at least the feedback that I've received for residents. And I've traversed all around the city. And so anything that we can do to make sure that we have the number of officers that we need with an increasing population in our city, I think everybody should be working towards that goal.
It seems to me it makes sense, and I think I've heard even some council members changing their view slightly, at least to publicly say public safety requires both all the social activities that can be done to steer people away from crime and to improve neighborhoods, plus police to help enforce and prevent crime. So I understand that. But you've targeted these areas, these five areas, and I'm thinking about people who live in other areas. You know, we've had random shootings at 14th Street around the ballpark and other places. Some neighborhoods, frankly, where there are often aren't shootings. Is targeting the area, these areas, going to solve the gun problem? Seems to me the bottom line, no matter what you think about crime, guns are the problem, and you don't really have a lot of tools to get the guns out of the city.
Yeah, so that is a problem, Tom. You know, as you mentioned, I mean, it really is. I mean, we have issues in different neighborhoods, and from some neighborhoods, you know, the threshold is, you know, one shooting. You know, you have a neighborhood up in arms. In other neighborhoods, you know, we see far too many incidents, and you know, and then there's an outcry about, you know, some of the things that are going on in there. And I think that's where we really get into the space of talking about these acute issues that we see in communities. There has to be enforcement, and there has to be accountability when people in those communities are violating the public trust and doing things that make those communities unsafe. I don't think there's any way around that. They can, you know, that can be debated. You know, whatever politics come into play, at the end of the day, you know, that's not my game. My game is public safety, and I'm want to do everything that I can to make sure that all the decision makers who need to make decisions, that they have the information that they need to make those decisions. And, you know, I don't want anybody saying, well, we didn't know. You know, the chief has been saying, hey, look, the number of people we have right now, it's not sufficient for what it is we are required to do in the District of Columbia. We will do the best we can with the resources that we have. The mayor has been very generous in terms of making sure any overtime that we need to provide public safety in the community, but that's not a good long-term strategy. Go ahead.
You have the ability of a Baptist preacher, so I have to cut you off there. You just said the number of people we have right now is not sufficient. I wrote it down. Have you had this discussion more with the council chairman of the Judiciary Public Safety Committee, Charles Allen of Ward 6? Does he agree with you that it's not enough? Does he just think you need to do a better job? What are your conversations with him like? I'm assuming that you have them.
Yeah, so we have conversations, and I think, you know, what I hear oftentimes is, you know, that, and there are things that the thing that we agree on is that, you know, that there should be of this and that approach, right? It should be police officers doing their job, and it should be, in addition to that, other service providers. But I think where the rubber really meets the road is, you know, what do we put the dollars behind, right? That's where, you know, all the talk kind of goes to the side. We really have to look at that. What are we supporting in terms of numbers? We are, and this number where we are right now is as a result of, you know, decisions that were made certainly before I got into the seat. You know, the numbers for the department have been dwindling, right? I'm just sounding an alarm at this point to say, hey, this is an issue, and we cannot continue on this path, because we'll certainly continue with the same results.
Well, here is Annie, who is in Brightwood. Annie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo and Tom and Chief Conti. Thanks for taking my question. I have a question for Chief Conti about whether the police are considering changing the strategies up there, because there has been a large presence, you know, that I've noticed every day. And I know the Longfellow Street shooting, there was a large presence there before it even happened. And it doesn't seem to be deterring the behavior. So if you could talk about just how that might be changing the police strategy, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
And Chief Condi, if in addition to explaining to Annie what the strategy is going to be there, you have said that the summer crime prevention initiative that targeted certain neighborhoods led to a 20% decrease in violent crime in those areas. So I'm assuming that you're going to use some similar strategies in decreasing crime in this Brightwood neighborhood and others. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's focusing on the people who we know in the communities that are unfortunately causing some of the issues that we're seeing, right? Focusing on the individuals that we know. And if you talk to, I'm sure, the caller and some of the other residents who live in these communities, we know who some of these individuals are. We absolutely do. Law enforcement knows. Grandmothers know, residents know, it's that house right there. You know, we know where the issues are, and we want to be very intentional about our focus on those individuals, leveraging the resources that our federal partners bring to bear, and being very aggressive in terms of making sure that we are working collaboratively with the U.S. Attorney's Office to prosecute those cases.
But what about the caller saying that, you know, police are there and they still have the crime? Police and other people have said this to me. Well, Tom, you have these crimes and the police get there within seconds, so they were close by, so that more police is not the issue.
We only have about a minute more with the chief, according to his schedule, but go ahead, Chief Condi.
Yeah, so here's the thing. So, yeah, if the police are there, and that's great. I appreciate the fact that people see them. That's where we get into this issue that, you know, I've been talking about. It's not the first time you're going to hear me say this. That's where the accountability piece comes in. If we're out there and we arrest a guy, you know, for a possession of a firearm or whatever it is, and community is seeing that guy back out in community 2 days later, I suggest that there's some other things beyond the police department that we need to assess.
You're talking about the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I'm talking about the entire system. It's not
or
just
judges.
The U.S. Attorney's Office. Sometimes, you know, those cases, and Tom, I think the best way to get to that is follow a case. Sometimes a case will make it past the U.S. Attorney's Office, or sometimes it doesn't make it past the U.S. Attorney's Office. Sometimes it's because we did bad police work. What I'm saying is that we have to look at that entire ecosystem in those cases where we talk about gun offenders, specifically violent gun offenders. We recovered over 1,500 illegal firearms so far this year. Those individuals in possession with those firearms, where are they? That is the question. Where are they and why are they where they are? Are they in community? And if so, why? Are they incarcerated? If so, why? Right? You know, what's happening in that space? It's okay. The accountability piece.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Robert Condi is the chief of police for the Metropolitan Police Department, and who sometimes works as a Baptist preacher. No, that's not true.
No,
Chief Condi, thank you, sir.
He's always a Baptist preacher.
Chief Condi, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, man, you two guys are two of my heroes, man. Thank you. I appreciate you guys.
You're welcome. Tom Sherwood, we don't have a great deal of time left, but Tom Sherwood won't be here next week because he is participating in a memorial for an individual who is well-known inside political circles in the District of Columbia.
Betty King.
And this weekend, there's going to be memorializing for Faith Dane. Can you tell us who Faith Dane was?
Well, if you've ever heard a bugle blow in the District of Columbia, it probably was Faith. I don't know. Did she run for mayor nine times? Nine times. Mm-hmm. She rode a horse. She's a Broadway. She was a Broadway
Has the unique distinction star. Of being the only candidate in the District of Columbia who got a financial contribution from the late Marlon Brando,
yes.
The great actor, because she was
an actor of great skill. She was a warm and loving person. She took a lot of ridicule because of her campaigns, because she never raised money. She didn't get a lot of votes. But she was part of the character and fiber of local Washington, D.C.
And if you were at a public event and you heard a bugle blow, it was likely
That's
Faith
right. If we had one, we'd blow it today.
She will be missed, and she's being memorialized this weekend. I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. A special thank you to Martin Ostermuhl, Ruth Tam, and Gabe Bullard, who all helped to make this week's show possible. Any big plans this weekend besides looking at that Maryland game?
Georgia Avenue, 3 miles of Georgia Avenue are
closed off
down,
all day Saturday.
And I just hope they've made some accommodations for our seniors and infirm people who need to still get about.
And that's all the time we have. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nan.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobstorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Natalie Yurevlivker. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.